Okay, so this is the formal name, but actually I'll be talking about intentions to look, or rather to make saccades, how they emerge and how they are switched from one intention to another, in particular in relation to area LIP. Now, what I want to talk, first to introduce it, and if everybody knows what I talk, then let me know. On the other hand, please stop me if anything is unclear, of course. The first three chapters actually can be. Organized by the task that the monkey performs. So the first is related to memory saccades, the second to memory anti-saccades, then to free choice, another variation of memory saccades, and until now it is about parietal cortex, and then I will discuss the possible relationship, implications to the relationship with prefrontal cortex. Now, everybody here knows what I'm talking about. I mean, I wonder if, because the audience is small, I can,
I mean. I think every word here is
Is what?
Diversion problem, I don't
know. Okay, now this, okay, so first of all, I mean, it's probably redundant, but why is it interesting at all? So the context, at least for me, is that of the mind-body problem. This is the big problem in the background. And I think there is no doubt that for philosophers, the contemporary neuroscience has changed the perspectives about the mind-body problem. And one can pick as an example the subject of free choice. So often in philosophy books, you find thought experiments in which a subject is being asked to make a movement either to the left or to the right, and the subject must choose. And then it is being discussed what makes him choose a specific alternative. But actually, you can do this. You can record the activity of cells when subjects perform this thing, and at least get an idea on what happens in the brain. And this is one thing that I will show you first results here about. Now, one aspect that for me is particularly interesting, one aspect of the mind-body problem that for me is particularly interesting, is that of the control of mental processes. Okay, it is related to notions like working memory, which was introduced as a part of the computer metaphor of, so it is like a computer memory that you can switch tasks on and off like a little bit like a computer does. I think it is, of course, only some sort of a metaphor, but you can start to handle, to put a handle on how these things are controlled. You will see in the continuation. Now, the mind is free of physical constraints, of the constraints of physics. I mean, it can do, in principle, it can do things not according to the order of the world. But actually, I believe that the order of the world is imprinted into the mind very profoundly. And one area in which this is particularly clear is that of sensory motor processing. Okay, so on the one hand, it is related to things that happen in the world, like movement that obey, of course, the laws of physics. On the other hand, it is related to mental action. Exactly. So that in principle, you can be in one, in your mind, you can be in one place and immediately switch to the other end of the world. And of course, I mean, as I said, I believe that not only beyond sensory motor processing, this is actually dimensions of the world are kept in the workings of the mind. I will get to it shortly. Now, within sensory motor processing, an interesting focus is that of the effect of understanding. So I'll give you an example. For instance, let's say I'm a monkey and I see, something here. Now, if I believe that this is a delicious cockroach or something like this, I will try to grab it, right? But if I believe that it is a toxic spider, then I will withdraw my hand as quickly as possible. So unlike, photosensitive bacteria, which respond in a fully automatic manner, always moving towards light, an important part of our being having minds is that we do things according to context. Now, one more thing that I want to mention is the problem of relationship between cortical areas, and which I believe is a major problem in neurobiology, because you often get similar response characteristics in different regions, and to understand what is different, nevertheless, if anything, is definitely important. So, sort of the take-home messages in very general terms can be that neuronal signals in the cortex contain well-defined response typologies. So there are, you can divide them to well-defined types and the dynamics which are pertinent to understanding the brain and the mind. So this is in the context of what is, can anything develop in a network? And I think that although you get many different, when you record, you get many different single cells, overall, you don't get all the, it is important to realize that you don't get everything that you can imagine. You get specific response types. Okay, now I'll be more specific. So first of all, saccades. I guess everybody here knows that there is a fovea, and if we see with high acuity via the fovea, and the important thing is that it imposes an element of serial processing on vision. We don't see everything at the same time. We see essentially with high acuity one thing at a time. We make several saccades per second. And every saccade requires transformations and choice. So, just as an illustration, I think that the order of magnitude of the number of saccades that we make in our lifetime is the same as the number of heartbeats. But whereas each heartbeat is automatic and almost requires no processing, is each saccade requires choice and understanding of what is being the ongoing understanding of the scene. So it's vital for high level vision. Now, what do we mean by intention? How does it relate to the sort of operating system concept of the mind? Basically, intention is a plan for a specific action. I mean, the action can be more specific all the way in all details, or just a little specific. But there is we don't just plan to do something. We always plan to do something specific. Yeah, it is subjective, and therefore, right, it is part of subjective life, and therefore, it is private. If I intend to do something, you don't have access to it, by definition, right? And most of the lifetime of intention is spent in memory. If it is a short, over a short time range, then it is a working memory. So intentions, the life cycle is basically emergence, and then emergence of a plan. Let's say, I want to go to London to visit London. So I formed the plan to go to London, and then I store it in memory. There it waits until comes a moment of decision in which it is either activated, in which case I go to London, I behave, it is open to all. The behavior is open to all. Or I cancel the decision, in which case there is no, it remains forever within my subjective life, and nobody knows about, can know about it in principle. So it's, this is intentions, and its relation to working memory. Now, if we want to, ask whether we can sort of put a coordinate system through the mind, or at least for its part that does sensory motor processing, but probably more than that, then what can we offer? We can offer at least, it seems that there are at least two axes that we can put. One is subjective time, which goes from past to future, where you can put the zero as the present time. And the other axis being the flow of information, which goes from the input, the sensory, to the output, the motor. Okay? Now, you can use this scheme to map mental events or neuronal events, as we will see. Now, the significance of this scheme is that it gives a convenient way. Each quadrant gets a specific meaning. So, for instance, this quadrant, it is in the motor, the memory is memory of our own action. It is part of it is directed to the past, sorry, it is directed to our memory of our own action is memory, and therefore it is about our past events, but about motor. Sensory motor would be here, and the next two ones, two quadrants, attention and intention are both directed to the future. But whereas intentions are plans to make actions in the future, attention is can be perceived as, I think, as plans to perceive certain things. So we change the filtering characteristics of our visual system, of our sensory systems, in a way that would fit our plans. Okay? Now, segregating between activity that belongs to this quadrant and this quadrant has been a very difficult task because the two of them are related, not only because they are oriented to the future. And I will relate to it shortly. Now, the next of the introduction, basically I want to show you that memory saccades reveal activity that might relay intentions. Oh, but alternatively, this activity can also be visual, whether attention or memory. So memory saccades were introduced by Kosaka and Wurtz in the mid-80s, and basically they are answers to the following problem. The problem is that when you have to having to dissociate a visual from motor in the activity of single cells, so that a typical saccade experiment goes like this, that there is a visual target. Where is this? Okay. A visual target is jumps from one location to another. The eye follows it shortly. The eye, fixating the original position, follows the jump after some latency. And now suppose you're recording from somewhere in the brain, and you see this kind of discharge, which begins after the jump and continues until the movement. Now, because this discharge precedes the movement, it can be motor. It can be part of the preparation of the movement. On the other hand, because it follows the jump of the target, it can be sensory. It can be visual. How do you discriminate between the two? Well, memory saccades are one standard way now to discriminate between them. And they run like this. There is a fixation spot, which the subject has to fixate. Then a target comes on. But the subject is supposed to leave his eyes on the fixation spot and not look at the target. The target goes off, but the subject has to, during this memory interval, the subject has to remember where the target had been, because when the fixation spot will go off, the subject has to look at the location where the target had been with a single saccade, and if the eye is indeed in some fixation window at this location, the subject is rewarded. So this is a memory saccade. Now, how do cells look in memory saccades? So, well, this is LAP, parietal cortex LAP. So everybody is familiar, I guess, with this pattern of okay. So these are you see, I mean, here this is eye position, and you see that the monkey at the beginning of the trial, the monkey obtains the fixation of the fixation spot, and remains on the fixation spot. Now, the first vertical line is the onset of the target, the red spot, peripheral red spot. This is the offset of the peripheral red spot. Then 1 second of memory, and then the fixation spot goes off, which is the go signal, and the, here the saccade is made to the target. And you see that in each of the 10 or more trials here, this cell is activated shortly after target onset, and then the activity goes down. During the time of the movement, there is no activity at all. And therefore, people say that by dissociating the activity in time, it shows that this cell is indeed visual and not motor. Okay? Now, if you recall, if you put the target in the opposite position, you get much less activity. So cells in LIP and in most, as in most saccadic cortical areas, tend to be directed in space, and there is a response field or a preferred direction. Okay? Now, sorry. how would this map so the visual cell would start firing a short time after onset of the target. So it is short time in the past, and as the target recedes into the past, the activity goes down. Okay, this is basically what we saw. Similarly, a motor cell would fire mainly around the time of the saccade, with very little activity, if any, around the time of the movement. Therefore, it is a motor cell, again, a directed one. Sorry, what? I'm sorry? Yeah, it is, here is the saccadic movement, and all the movements that I will be talking about are saccades.
During saccade, but not during the movement.
Sorry, during the target's presentation. Thank you. Okay. Okay, so V and M stand for visual and motor. basically it says that the V plus M plus says that the active direction in this trial is false in the visual and motor fields of the, I mean, activates the, and you will see why we use this for the meantime strange designation shortly. Right, I mean, let me come back to it when we talk about anti-saccades, okay? That's why. If I were talking only about memory saccades, regular memory saccades, it wouldn't make much sense. Yeah, but here the target is, I mean, the target and the movement are made in the same direction, and this is the direction. Basically, what we do is first to do a block of trials in which we see if a cell has any activity, Okay, we see such a cell. It does either the visual cell or the motor cell. I mean, we characterize its preferred direction, and we call it V plus M plus. For the meantime, it is strange. It will become clear very shortly. Okay, so how would the motor cell appear? So this is how it would look. Okay, so it starts with very little activity. When the movement is in the future, far in the future there is no activity. As the movement is approaching the present, the activity increases, and then it goes after the movement, it goes down. So it is and it is in the motor direction and in the future. Okay.
So if the activity goes down even before, you could imagine the cell which is purely planning, then it passes the command to other neurons which actually execute the movement. How would you call this neuron?
I'm sorry, I didn't get the beginning.
Imagine of the cell which is involved in the planning of the movement, but not in executing it. So it then passes the command to other neurons.
Okay, thank
so
you.
So it can shut down before the movement.
Right. I mean, I'm using now. Thank you for reminding me. Usually, motor. I mean, if I were talking now to an audience of oculomotor people, let's say, they would get mad at me for this. I'm using motor in a broader meaning here than is usually. Usually, motor is used to mean something that is tied much more directly to the immediately to the movement, and here I'm relating to it. Also in the sense of planning. I mean, if it is related to the movement, to the planning of the movement, for convenience now we call it motor. So that, but it has to be this pattern of activity that you saw before, essentially, that goes to the, I'll get back to this shortly. You'll see some relevant, okay. So this is a sustained cell. So when people use the memory circuits to dissociate between visual and motor, but then they saw that there are cells that are neither visual nor motor, but remain active throughout the trial, which couldn't be seen without memory, this type of activity. Okay, so it starts shortly after the target onset and continues until the movement. I'm sorry?
This is
LIP, which is in the parietal cortex. I mean, sometimes called the parietal eye region, if you, eye fields, I mean, if you want to.
Is it clear that you really, that you can separate cells in these categories?
Okay.
The only way of thinking about what's going on in LIP is to divide cells in visual
. So this relates exactly to the take-home message. I think that it does. I mean, basically, you don't see whatever you can imagine many types of responses that you don't find. I mean, and I'll show you one example that actually is related to your previous question shortly. I think, I mean, you get to see there is variability, a lot of variability, but nevertheless, there are sort of basic frames which repeat themselves in any single area. And this is an important piece of information. So a typical sustained cell starts shortly after the target onset and goes until the movement and is also directional. And the question then immediately becomes, if this is visual memory, like we saw, if the sustained activity is visual memory or intention, okay? Is this discharge related to the memory of this target that was here before, or to the planning of the movement? Okay, these are the three basic types of, people have done it several times, and these are the three basic types. There are more rare types. For instance, I mean, in particular, about 5% of the 3 to 5% of our cells were like this. I mean, it's a small portion. As far as I know, it wasn't reported before, But it is nevertheless interesting. So this is a mid-memory cell. It starts, it is not active during the visual phase. It is not active, it is completely silent during the, when the saccade is made. But it has a burst of activity in the middle of memory, okay?
The burst of activity is selective in some way for what?
I'm sorry, it's selective for?
Selective for what saccade, which saccade?
So we do memory saccades, and it has a preferred direction. You see here that it has a preferred direction, which for this cell is down by chance, okay? But and if you do it in the opposite direction, there is no activity.
But the memory activity has an orientation.
The memory activity?
Has a directional tuning.
Has a directional tuning, yeah. It is mid-memory. It is even, it is very different from the sustained pattern that we saw before. So, for instance, I mean, you could ask, to go back to what you raised, I mean, you could ask before, why there are no mid-memory cells? Well, there are, but very few. In the same manner, I could form any number of patterns and other patterns that are not there. I mean, if they are there, then you have to record thousands and thousands of cells. It is very, extremely rare.
But your argument,
what do you mean?
You record and you don't find them, so they're...
Which particular pattern?
Well, let's say two bursts that are divided by time. I mean, one burst here, and then another burst here. So if there is anything that repeats itself like this, you would really have to record thousands of cells, you know, because nobody reported it, and it's probably. So you could get one cell like this, but. I mean, maybe, I'm just saying, but if you try to categorize the cells in a reasonable manner, until now, nobody has managed anything like this.
Your argument is not so much that there is a very clear clustering in cell type, but more that there is a lack of cells that would cover some type of response. It's more like that. You're not saying that there is like nothing intermediate between mid-memory and sustained memory. It's more that you have very few mid-memory.
You have very few mid-memory at all. I mean, the three predominant types are the ones that I mentioned, but you have mid-memory. But other types that you could think of, I mean, you could basically draw any function here. If they are, they are rare. I mean, there is some sort of clustering. I don't want to say anything about its functional significance, if at all, but there is clustering. I mean, I think that when you look at it, you cannot just, I mean, it would be a mistake to ignore it. That's my impression. I don't know. So the question is immediately whether it is that rises up. Of course, this is not visual and not motor because it's not active during the visual phase or the motor phase. But is it sort of in visual or motor coordinates? I mean, is it related, is this memory?
So my question, it could still be motor planning, for example.
Exactly, that's why I referred. This could be some middle station in that is activated in motor and then it, like you said, or it could be a visual memory. Even though in the same, I mean, it could, right? Even though it is hard for me to understand why would, if I were to design a brain, why would you put 3 to 5% of your cost function, so to speak, in units that are active in the middle, regardless of whether it is memory.
Well, it's like in the army, you have a very high command which makes decisions and then go to sleep. Then there is mid-level commanders who go and make preparations.
Okay,
there are
field
commanders which do the job.
So this
if
is
you put all of them, you find 50% of the generals which go to sleep well before the battle. That's why you need the generals to not do it.
Okay, I mean you assume so. You have to to make a hierarchical assumption, which is not trivial at all, but yes, I mean, Interesting, in the past, I saw this to network people and they started to think about how sustained activity is being kept. I mean, this was the sort of direction that, how is it kept alive?
Sorry for interrupting you again, but one interesting dimension is thinking about how this context could develop. And it makes some difference if you think that there is a kind of a strict clustering, then you're led to think that there is really a kind of organizing a principle written out from the start that it were that you want sets of this type and sets of this type and so on. Whereas if you think of a kind of broad distribution of response types, which through some self-organizing processes, you dilute those that are less useful and you push cells to do like most of that, then it's more compatible with something that occurs spontaneously.
Maybe. I mean, but it's a very specific pattern. I mean, in this sense, I mean, although you could argue that there is a selection process that starts with the, if you make this assumption, it's not trivial at all, like the hierarchy. I mean, you really have to assume some kind of a sample of, some kind of a space of elements which are at the beginning, from which you select, and this is one type. This is a typical member. So what would they be? Would they be peaks in every time period? I mean, we can think about it afterwards. I mean, it's interesting, but I don't see a simple way to, in this case, to form up a space of an initial space from which you make the selection. I mean, because you basically suggest that this is a leftover from the selection. I mean, right? I mean, this is a, so it's a, okay,
the
so.
The variety of the time between the visual signal and the sucker, would this cell go with the visual signal or with the sucker?
I'm sorry, can you say this again?
Yeah, I understand that the time between the target and the actual sucker is fixed.
Right.
So if you vary this,
I don't know. I mean, we always try to. I mean, many people do this. I mean, randomize. Basically, in the way we do it is to vary the parameters that we care about. I mean, so for instance, in this case, the target space, and try to keep the others constant. For two reasons which are technical, so maybe I want to really, I mean, one of them is the monkey's performance. I think the monkeys perform better this way. And the other is that it makes the life easy. I mean, although you always have the questions, what if we did it different? I mean, you know what happened in these conditions, clearer, okay. So these are the two possibilities, right, for the mid-memory cells. Okay, let's get on. So basically, the question, I mean, the mid-memory are rare. I don't want to devote too much. The basic phenomenon is the sustained activity, and the question that comes up is whether it is visual or motor, right? And for this, we need to introduce additional dissociation tasks, and such a dissociation task is one such dissociation task is memory anti-saccades. Right. I mean, in the sense that okay. Let's go back to it after we continue. We'll come back to this cell. Okay. So one nice task that dissociates the sustained activity.
You define some notions and then you say basically you change the definition. So then you have to define what the question is.
Please be more specific.
Well, you say you define the visual cell as the cell with this property,
yes,
and the motor cells with that property.
Right.
How you show the cell it's neither this or that,
yes.
Then you still ask if it's visual or motor.
Right. I mean, let me refine the question. Is this strange activity related to the memory of the visual target, or to the to the movement that will happen, to the subsequent movement? Okay, maybe at this point I know that if I were you, I would ask myself if it is well defined. So let's leave it right now and go back to it in a few slides. Okay.
Make sense of this cell.
So this is the meaning of what I meant. Okay. Memory anti-saccades, how they would look, they look very similar to memory pro-saccades, regular memory saccades, okay? But so they start with a fixation spot that has to be fixated as long as the fixation spot is on. And now a target comes up. The way we do it is to have a different color. So red would mean that the monkey would have to look towards the location where the target had been. When the target is green, there is a subsequent interval, and then the subject has to look to the opposite location where the target had been. And if the subject does it, then the subject gets reward. Okay? Now, in 1997, Schlagrey and collaborators analyzed this activity. They found different things found certain things about the activity related to anti-saccades in supplementary eye fields. But they also presented in the same paper what can be called the inversion problem. So in the sort of geometrical configuration of a regular memory saccade trial is like this. One can define a visual vector. It would start from the fixation spot or from the center of the orbit, right? And go to the, watch out, it's your cup fell. Okay. And it goes until the location of the target on the screen, right? And now, what the brain has to do is to produce muscle activations that will move the eye, rotate the eye, so that the end point of the movement, with respect to the initial point of the movement, this we call the motor vector, will be the same as the visual vector, okay? So this is the standard, this is sort of canonical sensory motor transformation. Okay, but in an anti-saccade, the situation is different. The visual vector is identical in memory anti-saccades and memory pro-saccades. But the motor vector is the inverse. So the brain must compute an inversion transformation. And the question they brought up, the Schlags brought up, is where is it being done and how, okay? In addition, they did not only bring up, present this problem, but also suggested a solution. And this drawing sort of captures their solution. They said, let's say there is in some area of the brain a visual cell. Let's say that the target falls in the upward direction. So the up-directed visual cell basically gets input from early visual cells that have receptive field upwards, right? But they said, now when the monkey is being trained for anti-saccades, new connections are formed or changed, doesn't matter, but suddenly the cell, this visual cell, has a new receptive field, which is downward, okay? They were motivated for this hypothesis by the finding of Mickey Goldberg and collaborators of what is called the shifting or remapping of visual fields, which is very different, and I won't go into it. But this is the hypothesis that they presented in their paper. Basically, when we saw this, we did not think that this hypothesis is likely at all, because we were recording in area LIP, and we had the cells, like we talked before, we had cells with visual activity and cells with motor activity, which, one, of course, there are all kinds of recurrent connections, but basically there is some sort of a flow of information like this. I mean, one could imagine a flow of information like this. And then all you would have to have is in order to obtain the inversion transformation, all you would have to do is to change the connections between the visual fields and the motor fields, right, which are already present in this area. So we thought that the visual motor connection reconnection hypothesis, one could call it, is more likely than their visual switching hypothesis. Also, from the point of view of LIP and also most other oculomotor cortical areas, I mean, if switching occurs so early, then basically they are out of the game. This is another consideration. So this seemed to us more likely. Okay, so let's continue. So now we have four types of trials, which are typically randomly interleaved. Okay, so we have two classes in what I will show you. Two classes are the of trials are the ones that you saw before: regular saccades towards the receptive fields, or in the opposite direction. And now, so in regular saccades or prosaccades, as they are called in this context, the movement is always in the same direction as the target. Okay, but in anti-saccades, it is always opposite. So always we do it after mapping the response field. So always in anti-saccades, either the movement is in the preferred direction of the cell, but not the visual target, or the opposite. Okay, and that's the reason for this designation that you mentioned before. So let's see how the cells behave in this task. So let's start with the visual cell. So this is the same cell that we saw before, that in its activation in time is just after the target, and so therefore it is probably visual. What we expect here is that it will, when the target falls in the class of anti-saccades in which the target falls in the receptive field, it would be activated as well. What we get is just this, okay? So, and in the same way, what we expect when the movement falls in the response field, but not the visual target, is that there will be no response, right? And this is just what we get. So you see that this cell responds if and only if the visual target falls in the receptive field of the cell, regardless of the movement's direction. And therefore, it is indeed visual. Now, for convenience, we I'm sorry? Back one slide, you mean? Ah, okay. Sorry. In the regular saccades, we have V plus, M plus. Both of them, both visual and movement, are in the preferred direction or the opposite. In anti-saccades, we have either the movement is in the preferred direction or the visual target in the preferred direction, but never both. Okay? Okay, so it is defined by a previous block in which we do regular memory sakats, only by regular memory sakats. So, we know from previous work that if a cell has both visual and motor, then it is almost always the same direction, or very close direction. So there is one active direction. So it is more, the significance of this is more that the locations, we have a plus direction, and now we can put the V and the M, each one of the V and the M, either in that direction, in the plus direction, or the minus direction. Okay? Okay, so...
The plus and minus are well defined for purely visual and purely motor.
No, they're well defined for they're not well defined for all the cells in the world, but in this, basically, to simplify things, let's now assume that they are. Okay, so you have one direction, we have one preferred direction in which you get activity, and the other direction in which...
Direction of what? Of stimulus or
of... We start with memory sakats. That is always, always they are the same. Now you scan all the directions.
Okay.
You find a region which generates activity. It can be visual, it can be motor, it can be sustained, it can be...
Or whatever, you just sum it up.
Yeah. You just find the one, that is, okay.
So is that little bit of activity in the D minus condition, is that real?
It's there. So in order to really to give it some weight, to be, we form a differential activity, which is just this minus this. And it is clear that you get a visual and motor, you get sort of a visual motor axis, because if this is zero and only this is active, it would be purely negative. This is more or less the situation in this cell, okay? And if it is motor, it will be the opposite. So this is the motor cell. We expect activity in M plus, right? And this is what we get. We don't expect activity in M minus, so again, this is consistent, and if you form the differential activity, you get activity in the motor direction and also in motor timing, right? Okay, what happens with the sustained... I'm sorry?
I thought
the
dash line was one
this dash line?
Yeah, both the activity
after... This is the time of the saccade. So again, the trial starts when the monkey enters the fixation window, begins fixating this fixation spot, and this dashed line is when the fixation spot goes off. In the middle of the fixation period, the peripheral target is flashed on and off. Okay.
Did he make the intervening period longer out of the behavior of the motor and visual cells?
We...
Is that a fixed amount or...
Yeah, in our case, in the experiment that I'm telling you now, it is always 1 second. When people started to see these things, in particular when people started to see these things in the parietal cortex, the first one that did it was Richard Anderson with Jim Gnat at the time. In the initial paper, they had several memory durations, and they saw that the activity that begins with a target always continues until the movement, regardless of when it is made. Now, actually, it is more complex than that. Some cells, in the true sustained cells, this is like this. But some sustained cells, after some time, they run off. Sort of have a limited energy. But if you can always cut it shorter, you can always cut the activity shorter if you make the sakats earlier. Okay, so.
Is this dissipation of energy fixed in time? So it's like.
No,
half a second always, no matter how long you have to remember, or is it...
You're talking about sustained cells.
I'm talking about these cells.
No, so this is increase. This is a build-up.
Visual ones, they decrease, right?
Okay, so No, there are visual cells that are visual memory cells that continue, I mean here, if you look for continuum of when you go over the visual cells defined as I did now, you have different decay sort of decay constants. Some cells continue.
The question is if this decay constant would not increase if you delay in the
sometime. This I don't know.
Right. So I
would expect that not, nevertheless.
You would expect
that not. That if you increase if you make the saccade very close to the target, then it would be different, but it's not really memory. But if you would increase the memory duration in this cell to 3 seconds, yeah. I would definitely expect that it would not change anything.
So if I made the saccade twice as long, you would expect the same curve, right?
Yeah. But twice as long, you mean the duration of the memory?
Right.
Okay.
That's what I mean.
Yeah,
you
I think it's...
You expect this thing to be exactly the same. It would just be...
That's my expectation, yeah, definitely. Okay, so
if not, you wouldn't call this visual cell.
I'm sorry?
If you would see the corresponding expansion of the.
Okay, let's. This is another one in which, another case. We have to go to the back to the mid memory cell, but this is another one that we will actually go very briefly. So this is a sustained cell, and the question is, what do we expect here? Is it. And here there is this question has been treated a lot in the literature. I mean, is it the intention to make the saccade, or is it visual memory, or perhaps attention? Okay, so if it is, what do we expect? If it is intention, that is the planning of the movement, we expect it to be some sort of a build-up in the M plus direction, right? And indeed, this is what we find. We find that when the target goes off, a buildup begins that continues, increases, and peaks more or less at the time of the saccade. Had it been a visual memory, what would we expect? We would expect to see a peak at around the time of the target, or shortly after the time of the target, and then a decay, right? But if it is visual memory, then we expect that that it will not decay to zero, but rather be kept, because memory is kept. And this is indeed what we get in this specific cell. So if you look only at this, it looks like an intention. If you look only on this, it looks like a visual memory. And actually, there are cells that look only like this, or only like this, okay? But
you say you didn't see bimodal cells, but this is sort of bimodal cells.
Right. So this is
You don't see bimodal. You call this sustained, right?
I didn't say that we don't see bimodal cells. I mean, this is not a. Of course, we see.
What kind of cell you didn't see?
I told you two peaks. No, I told you two peaks. I was careful because we see a lot of bimodal cells, a lot of cells that have a peak in the visual and the motor. I said two peaks, segregated in time, in the middle of the memory.
Okay, maybe 1 second is not enough.
So if you made this thing 10 seconds, would you see?
You would probably see one peak.
Bathtub, or would you see it sustained?
I'm sorry, it was simultaneous.
If you made this thing 10 seconds, right?
Yeah.
And then before you told me that for the visual cells, the decay was fixed in time.
Uh-huh.
And in the motor cells, let's assume it's fixed in time. Then if I made this 10 seconds, would you just see these two things with a gap, or would you see sustained activity?
Most cells have sort of a time constant, I mean, which can be sort of infinite in the sense that they keep firing as long as we check, or it can be limited. But it doesn't seem to rely on the duration of the memory, I mean, essentially.
Of course, we hadn't done the experiment in this cell, so I cannot tell you. But I would expect that this would be kept more or less at a constant level, okay? And here the question is, when would it start? But it would probably, one could think of a cell that starts at the end of this and now. How exactly would it vary? Would the slope of the increase be lower? Possibly, I don't know. These are already now. So now, Misha, I'm not sure what you say that. What did you say again?
Well, I said this is bimodal cell, just two overlapping.
Yeah. This is. Okay. We have here terminology. What we call bimodal usually is visual and motor without sustained activity. Okay, but this is bimodal in a different sense. Yeah, definitely. It is that's why it's interesting, because it shows that looking just at regular memory saccades, but it shows that some cells, you cannot always, you don't have a situation in which a cell is only intention or only visual memory. It is definitely, in this specific cell, not all cells, but this specific cell is definitely a combination of the two. No. The cells that I'm showing you are very well isolated. Of course, like everybody, in the whole brain, you do extracellular recordings. You don't do intracellular. But, you would basically, to say that this cell is more than one cell, would have to, to turn around, working wisdom, I'm not sure how to say it in English, of the last 40 years of recordings. These cells have very clear, well-isolated, repeating spike waves and so...
What's the peak frame?
The ones that I show you. You have the scale on the... it's cut. It's 20 spikes, but spikes per second. And so this is 20... this one is 20 spikes per second. So I don't know. In this case it would be 40, but it's not typical. Usually, often you would get a lower rate. It's not necessarily. Sometimes you get a high rate. Okay, I'm not saying that this is the... You can form the differential activity in the anti-condition, like we did before. And actually here you see that, in this case you get a clear changes, right? In the visual direction, you had much more activity in the beginning, and then it went down. In the motor direction, there was the opposite dynamics. So what you get is something that is begins relatively that begins turns sharply in the visual direction shortly after the target onset, and then it goes down, and sometime during the memory it crosses to the motor direction and remains in the motor direction until the saccade. So this cell is actually implementing the solution to the inversion problem, right? People looked in the context of anti-saccades mainly on frontal regions. Anti-saccades are used a lot, for instance, in the study of schizophrenics, which have a difficulty in performing anti-saccades. And it is thought mainly, in terms of not being able to withhold the saccade towards the target. Basically, you see that the involvement of the parietal cortex in this is to compute the inversion transformation. This is a mean of 400 neurons of all, not only sustained, visual, whatever goes. And you see, and the gray is the 95% confidence interval, and you see that it starts at zero, and then shortly after the target onset, turns in the visual direction, but then very soon goes back, and then turns in the motor direction, and exactly what you need. Okay? So basically, these cells compute the inversion transformation. We have a lot of measurements from neurons, and we compute something that is some kind of an average, and we see that it goes from one direction to the other, and we are very happy. But how do we know that it really has any relevance? I mean, that this sum really determines what a monkey would do, in a sense. Well, we looked at specific errors. I mean, and the errors that we, I mean, so we have a memory interval, right? And during which the monkey has to keep fixation. If the monkey breaks fixation, then it is an error, and the trial is aborted. So we looked at the direction of these fixation breaks as a function of the time during the trial. Okay? And what we expected to find was if this inversion really has relevance to the behavior, we expected that the fixation breaks early in the trial would be in the visual direction, and fixation breaks in the motor direction would be more late. There would be more fixation breaks late in the trial. And essentially, I mean, this slide doesn't explain itself so much. Essentially, this is what seems to be the case, but it is, okay, maybe on this one I won't get into details. This is the mid-memory cell. So is it related to the visual direction or the motor direction? I mean, we can form a vote and see what people would think. But this is the result, I mean, that it is related. You see that in this way, it is well-defined. The question is well-defined, and you get that this cell is related to the visual direction.
Right? More.
Yeah, okay, right, both, but clear much more to the visual direction. Okay, so again, why would you need, and this repeats itself, I mean, we have, I don't know, don't remember the number now, but...
So you don't show the memories, the signal for the... You say it would fire, no memory, it breaks that up and there's a memory.
I'm not saying this. No, I'm not saying this. This I don't know. We didn't test him. But when you test in this specific task, you see that there is activity. Even though there is no activity, I'm sorry?
It fires more in this condition than even in B plus.
Right, yes.
But the signal which tells where to saccade is already known. Okay.
But nevertheless, when it is present, the signal that tells when to saccade, when it is really a visual stimulus, there is no activity.
Yeah,
it's
a different visual signal.
Only something like a... I don't know what, more than half a second after the onset of the target and roughly half a second, or a little less in this case, after the offset of the target. Right. Okay. I have to tell you that it is, it is well known, and we also did controls, that the color can change a little bit the intensity of the response, but not in a very strong way. I mean, clearly, the green and red are isoluminant. What?
Here it did change, but this is higher response.
No, but if you do, I mean, this is already a more complex task. If you do, we did the controls in which the color of the target had no significance. So we did red, green, red, all kinds of such things in which the monkey knew it wasn't used as a modulating signal for the behavior, but it was irrelevant for the behavior. And then, I mean, there were differences. I mean, there is variability, but they were small. Now, this doesn't come as a surprise because it is well known for a long time that the parietal cortex is not, you don't expect this. I mean, so, you don't, and that's why we did this and others do the same. I mean, to use color as a, Okay. So, going back to this...
You will show first this signal in some color, and only, let's say, halfway you could change. Let's say you should start it with white, and then you change it either to green or red. So then for the half of the trial, you...
Yeah, I mean, this is already technique. I mean, this is, we did controls, I mean, but it's not, again, it's not a, if it was something that was unexpected, then I would really go into details. So what does this say? Until now we saw that the inversion transformation is computed by the parietal cortex. But how is it computed? I mean, so we had two hypotheses, right? And so what does this cell, the emergence of the M plus activity is gradual, and this goes down slowly, so, sorry. So it looks more to me at least, it looks more like appropriate for the visual motor switching hypothesis that we had. This is basically what we expected to see happening, not in exact detail. So is there any evidence for the visual switching hypothesis, or can we rule it out? So, surprisingly for us, there is evidence for the visual switching hypothesis. So, look at this cell. If you look at these three panels, it looks like a visual cell, a standard visual cell. So, when the visual stimulus falls in the response field, the cell responds. When it is out of the response field, the cell doesn't respond, okay? But when you look at this special class in which the monkey makes the movement into the response field, the cell is also active, even though the target doesn't falls in the opposite direction. So what happens here? It is clear, the first thing to notice, well, we saw build-up cells, right? We saw build-up cells in which the activity appeared in this direction, but it started early in the trial, and it peaked at the time of the movement. So it was clearly related to the preparation of the movement. But what happens here? So if you just look at this panel, it would look to you, and apply the usual dissociation in time criterion, I would say that this is visual, because even though there is a little decay, during the time of the movement, there is almost no activity. Most of the activity follows the target, even though with a little bit higher, longer delay than in the visual response, okay? So this activity looks paradoxical, because it is visual by timing, okay, but motor by direction, you could say. So in the sense that it happens in the M plus direction. Right. Okay. But when it happens, I'm not saying that it is motor, but when it happens, when you look only, then it happens in the M plus direction. Okay. It is sort of, you have to have something more. It is at least, let's say, I mean, I don't want to get into some, it is visual by timing, and it is not visual by direction, okay?
There's no topography to the cell. You just look anywhere in LRT and you find it. It's not like one region of LRT.
As far as we know, until now, there is no one region. I mean, but I'm not certain about this. I mean, we still did not do the histology, and so I cannot really answer with this. We are not aware of at present of a region. Okay. So is the paradoxical activity, one can ask basically two questions. First of all, what causes the paradoxical activity? And secondly, is it good for anything? Well, it does seem to be good for something. I mean, and this is that first of all, I have to tell you, I didn't tell you that in order to really see that this activity is paradoxical, you have to look at visual cells. But because there it is clear that you don't expect in V minus M plus trials, you don't expect visual activity. There is no visual activity. But you do get, one can say that you do get a paradoxical activity also in sustained cells. Okay? So for instance here, this is the sustained cell that you saw before, and this is another sustained cell that begins after the target and goes until the movement in regular saccades. Then when you look at it at using memory anti-saccades, you see that there is a visual response that goes down. Here there is sort of a build-up that goes until the movement. But overriding this build-up, there is this discharge, which has a very brisk onset and continues for a few hundred milliseconds, and then goes down. So this thing looks just like a paradoxical activity added to the build-up, right? Of course, if we didn't have the visual cells, we would be careful about this segregation. But having the visual cells, I mean, we can say, now what is the effect? What is the influence? We assume that part of the function of these cells here is to invert, to go from the visual direction to the motor direction. What is the effect on the differential activity of the presence of paradoxical activity in this cell? It has a drastic influence, because when you compute the differential activity, you see that it is visual only very briefly for something like 50 milliseconds, and then it is drastically direct, goes to the opposite direction and remains there until the saccade. So the one possible function of the paradoxical activity in these cells might be that it accelerates the inversion transformation. Now here I want to add a speculation. I mean, I don't know about topographical order, but what seems to be, and again, I'm not sure that this is true. I mean, we haven't, this is not something that we really analyzed carefully, but it seems that these monkeys are experts in memory anti-saccades. And they're doing it for day after day. And when you also, in the configuration that we did it, there is no significance to time. They do not have to compute. They have a full second, or rather a second and a quarter, to come up with the inversion, with the reply to the with the calculation of the inversion. Okay, but you could think that you exercise here mechanisms that in nature do have advantage to be fast. Okay, because you don't have a second of memory when you have to withdraw your hand from a spider. So what seems to be the case is that the paradoxical activity is stronger in monkeys that do this for a long, long time. So it could be sort of a learning that goes on, and that sort of expert knowledge, the formation of expert knowledge. So that when monkeys the first memory anti-saccades, most of their cells would look like this. Okay? But when the fast, the more experienced they become, the more cells they would have that look like the bottom. Yes, please.
So what about the
I'm sorry, I cannot hear you. We did not do this, and the reason that we did not do this is that we wanted the monkeys. I mean, then you would have a city. You would start to ask yourself, well, does the monkey from the beginning wonder if in this present trial the color would be switched? I mean, you have this. I mean, when you really go into the details. You have this kind of so in my mind it is better to keep. I mean, if you want to do an experiment on switching, you have to do the experiment on switching. But these monkeys know that this is. They see red, they have to do this. They see green, they have to do this. I mean, we try to keep it as well defined for the monkey as possible. So therefore, I don't know the. But it's an interesting question. That's, okay, so back to the what causes the paradoxical activity? So the paradoxical activity is in a visual cell, as according to the standard criterion of memory saccades, and it is only in anti-saccades in the opposite direction. It seems just like what you would expect from the receptive field remapping hypothesis.
I'm not clear about this hypothesis. Can you explain again what this hypothesis is?
So the hypothesis is, I mean, the drawing is not the slide. I drew it, but this is the spirit of the hypothesis. So you have a vision, let's say you record in a LIP, a visual cell that likes the upward direction. Mm-hmm. Okay? So obviously this cell must get input from, let's call it early visual areas, V4, MT, indirectly from the retina, from cells in, it's actually drawn opposite, never mind, but it gets input from early visual cells that have the same receptive field. So this is the solid line. It goes, if it is prosaccades, the target is red in our case, you get strong input that goes to the up visual cell. What happens when the target is green? So what they suggest is that there is an alternate connection that is activated in these conditions. Okay.
The target is down, but it's green. No,
the target. Sorry. Yeah. So this. Let's say. Okay. It is actually. You're right. I mean, it is.
Or by down green.
I'm sorry.
The idea is that the cell can be activated either by up red or by down green.
This is the. So what happens is that. I mean, they don't go into the specifics. Mm-hmm. And maybe I'm not sure. Maybe I should have really drawn it into a down. Never mind. I mean, this is not. But this is the idea, okay? That in anti-saccades, connections are activated from the opposite, from early visual cells, with the opposite receptive field.
And which data are you saying is consistent with that idea?
The paradoxical cells, right? I mean, now let's look back at this cell. So it is a visual cell. We say that here. It is a visual cell with an, in this case, upward visual field. Okay, according to this and this, this is very clear. And here we have something that is paradoxical, we said. It is not consistent with this cell being a visual cell. But here, this is what you would expect if now an alternate visual receptive field is activated, right? So it seems consistent with the. It is not. It does. It's not. That not seems. It is consistent with their hypothesis. So one possibility for explaining.
Do you expect that it shouldn't fire at all for this V plus and minus?
I'm sorry, I didn't get.
For V plus and minus, it shouldn't fire. It would be consistent, sort of clearly, if it were. Because the remapping only happens one condition, but what is that?
For V plus, I'm sorry, I don't get here, just a minute. Yeah. For V plus A minus, right. It is a, okay, right. I mean, this is very easy to settle. You only have to assume that now you have red plus green, okay? It is an extension of the receptive field, rather than an alternate.
All of the cells know like this.
Yes.
Then it would mean that the condition V minus M plus, twice as many cells would be M.
Okay, it means that there is more activity, and indeed, it might be that when you get a paradoxical activity, more cells are active, but in the end, it accelerates the population is inverted. What does it do to the population? It probably, from single cells, like the sustained cell that I showed you, it seems that it accelerates the inversion, right? I mean, so... So it is true that it is not consistent with a sort of exclusive or, but it is much more consistent than we ever expected to find. But nevertheless, there is. Sorry, you were.
I was going to say. I mean, you could tell a story about this cell that said when the monkey is in the anti-psychotic case. Sees the visual stimulus, then he imagines where he's going to see conscious. So now he's having a mental imagery in the V plus position, and that's what, because that activity is slightly delayed. The V minus M plus is slightly delayed compared to V plus M minus.
Great. So there seem to be two possibilities to explain the paradoxical activity. One possibility is the variation. Probably you're probably right that not exactly as they said it, but a variation of what the Schlags suggested. But the other, oh yeah, in any case, just a minute. Let me orient myself. I'm sorry. Okay. So in any case, even if it is, then we have something to note, and this is that. This is something very remarkable because this switch would have to happen. I mean, we would have to have the context. This depends on context. I mean, the monkey sees the color of the stimulus in these conditions and very rapidly generates a signal that reverses reverses or extends, never mind the details, of the receptive fields. Okay, so. In any case, it would be remarkable. The other possibility is that it is re-entrant input, which would be just like you said, Ken, or, I mean, you could think of other. And this re-entrant input, I mean, basically also has to rely on a switching signal, which is the output of some context categorization. It can act on the visual cells or on the motor cells. I mean, but definitely, there is this alternative. And these are, for the data basically that I showed you, these are the two possible explanations. In any case, I should emphasize that the conditions that in which we get the paradoxical activity we don't know exactly what are the conditions to generate paradoxical activity, but it is clear to us that they are very specific, very special. For instance, what happens when we get the paradoxical activity is that at the same time, the monkey gets the information about the location of the stimulus and the identity of the task. And these are preliminary results, but this is a cell in which we ask simply if we distinguish between the two in time. If we let the monkey know in advance what is the task that will have to be done in this trial, how is it going to have an effect on the paradoxical activity? What we get is this. I mean, this is a cell. A visual cell like you saw before, essentially, there is a response in the two visual classes, right? And there is paradoxical activity in the paradoxical class, in the V minus M plus And now we actually run it randomly interleaved with another group of four trial classes, which are identical to these four, in the same, but with one exception. And this is that during the midway through the initial fixation interval, we let the monkey know what the task will be. That is, we flash, we change, I think, the color of the fixation spot in this case. We change the color of the fixation spot so that it will, so that the monkey will know. So if it is a prosaccade, we change the color to red. So it is white from here to here, half a second, red from here to here, another half a second, and then white again for another half a second. And then the trial proceeds as before. And if it is anti-saccad, it is green. The fixation spot is, and look what happens to the paradoxical activity. It is gone. Now these trials are randomly interleaved with these trials and all the other trials. Nevertheless, you get very clear paradoxical activity when the input is synchronous, not simultaneous, and you don't get it when the monkey knows in advance. Yes.
Another interesting thing here is that relates a bit to what Misha was saying about the partial versus full remapping.
That what? I'm sorry?
The partial versus... This notion of remapping is a bit misleading because it seems to imply complete switch of...
You mean of the hypothesis?
Yeah. The word remapping is a bit...
Well, I mean, it is a clear concept, right? Yeah. Basically a clear concept. I'm not saying that it holds. I agree with you, basically. I mean, that it is...
But I would like to point out is the fact that when you don't have... You have the cue that suppresses the paradoxical activity, then the V plus and minus signal is stronger, right?
Right.
Which would be conceivable that... When you do have the paradoxical activity, there is some kind of competition between paradoxical V minus and plus and V plus and minus, that both signals are there, but they are both kind of halfway.
I should have said, and actually about a year before our paper came out, there was a study of Jackie Gottlieb and Mickey Goldberg using anti-saccades in the same region, and they used the changes of the fixation spot, changes of color or shape, I don't remember now, of the fixation spot, and they found exactly this kind of different gains, sort of task specific gains. I mean, that do this, but. Okay, there are. I completely agree that besides what I'm showing, I mean, there are all kinds of. When you really want to form the competition, I mean, there are gains. But nevertheless, I mean, you see that. You see here as the paradoxical activity, and here not. I mean, this is the. But there are. In our data, the truth is that we still didn't analyze it carefully. There are cells that are, the response is stronger in anti-saccades, and other cells that it is stronger in pro-saccades. I mean, and where exactly the balance is, I'm not sure. But what I'm showing you is what is, we found that is consistent. And, okay, but in any case, this is not the case in all the cells. Not always it goes down in such a brisk manner, and this is a preliminary result. It is nevertheless consistent. What I thought that you would say was from the beginning of what you said was that it seems to be inconsistent with the remapping hypothesis. But because if by knowing in advance. That the task, I mean, you don't get a visual response, you don't get paradoxical activity, I mean, by knowing in advance, I would expect that if anything, the switch will already be made. I mean,
maybe so. I think about it, it's too much of an all or none concept to be true.
In what sense?
That it implies by the very word remapping that either there is a remapping or there is not. Whereas maybe it would be more useful to look at it as one of the several influences that affect the idea of this self.
Okay, but it's but there is a difference. There is as far as I can see, a big difference between if it is recurrent connections or if it is the visual input that is being modulated. So
is this,
okay.
Is this always the case in your hand that the task PQ suppresses, or is this just one example?
No, it's one example. As I told you, this is part of a preliminary. But there are cases in which it is clearly. Completely suppressed. I mean, this is when you look at the population. I mean, there is of course variability, but roughly, you can it shows here is that out of something like 180 cells, roughly for two thirds of the cells, there is no. I mean, what it shows is the mean response for these three types of classes. So the thin lines. Are the visual responses in prosaccades and anti-saccades, okay? And and basically you see, by the way, that they roughly overlap each other. I mean, but and this is the mean response in this group of anti-saccades. And basically you see that for roughly two-thirds of the cells, there is very little, if any, paradoxical activity. For the other third of the cells, there is paradoxical activity. It is typically, its latency is longer, which is reasonable because obviously switching takes time, and whatever the mechanism is. And then for this group of cells, when there is paradoxical activity, it roughly overlaps with the visual, I mean, the visual response is stronger because it begins with a stronger transient. But when they become uniform in time, they are for this third, they are roughly of the same size. And then they go down.
Population average.
Yeah, this is 56. I mean, we divided, what does it come to? 185 cells to two groups. And this is.
Population
I'm sorry?
They're not examples, they're population
average. These are population means, yes. Okay, so it shows you. So basically, there are two sweeps of activity that go through LIP. There is a first sweep, which is bottom up, visual. And then about 50 to 100 milliseconds later begins a second sweep of activity, which is the paradoxical activity. Of course, it is a complementary set of cells, like we said. It's not the same cells, okay? But when you look at LAP, you have these two sweeps going on in anti-saccades. But it seems, I mean, it seems at least to us, I mean, that to a certain extent, our data solves the problem presented by the Schlagrey and collaborators, the inversion problem, not fully, but to a certain extent. But nevertheless, our data basically bring up another question, and this is the question of switching, okay? Because we know now. That within very quickly, within 50 to 100 milliseconds, the population all goes up. So the effect of switching is very, very fast. Sorry. So basically, we have what is the situation? We have a visual space, and then a stimulus location is fed to the sensory motor transformation. Okay, which in a normal in the sort of the canonical state. It then produces the identity transformation and manufactures a motor vector fed into motor space. But actually, at the same time, we have input, which in our case is the stimulus color, fed into a context categorization model. And the context categorization is fed as a switching signal into the sensory motor transformation module, okay, and switches according to the task. And the problems that arise are, first of all, where in the brain and how is the task inferred from stimulus color? And secondly, how does the switching signal act on sensory motor transform on the sensory motor transformation? How does it act to bring about the paradoxical activity in essence? So the conclusion of this part is that LAP's neuronal activity reveals and maybe determines the switching sensory motor transformations by context. And there are two sweeps. The first sweep being a bottom-up visual response, and the second being either receptive field remapping or reentrant activity. We don't know yet. Okay. Next, so this is this was the chapter on the inversion problem and the switching problem. And now we come, I'm sorry?
We take a 5 minute
break.
I just need 5 minutes.
Okay. I'll just say that if you look what philosophers write, I mean, they go back to the same thought experiment that I mentioned before, and then they go into a lot of speculations. I'm just asking
if you use these words in the same meaning as other people use when they talk about free will, or you distinguish them.
So free will is used in more than one way. Definitely generally used, even among philosophers, as far as I can tell from looking at their books. I'm, of course, not a... It is used in more than one way. And I don't know. I think that, I'm talking about a situation in which you have to decide if to look left or look right. This is, in essence... And there are two motivations here. One is to see what happens to the cell. I mean, so these cells might be representing intentions. What happens in this situation?
All you talk about particular cells that you showed? Or?
Well, let's say the sustained cells.
The sustained cells
that we saw before. And take a sustained cell that has only, well, I showed only one example in order to, but take a sustained cell that has no visual response, no visual memory-like response, only a build-up towards the saccade, which is supposed to be intention, which might represent the intention of the monkey. But it is, you know, all these experiments, which were now done by several groups, and it's clear that this is there, are generated in a situation in which the monkey is the intention is created like this. I mean, almost reflexively. I mean, it sounds strange to talk about reflexive intention. I mean, but you train the monkey for a long, long time to generate an intention according by a cue. I mean, you have an instruction to generate intention, and the monkey learns it and does it very well.
So you would call this free choice?
Wait, no, I'm talking now about the basic situation.
Okay
so. The basic situation in which you study sustained activity is that you bring the activity into existence all of a sudden. Okay, it's zero and then it's one. I mean, because you Because of the way that you, because of this training, long training, okay. Now, in nature, it happens. So, let's say you're very hungry and you see an advertisement for some kind of food, immediately you want this kind of food. You intend to go and pick up this kind of food, okay? So it happens that the intentions come into being as a almost reflexive response. Nevertheless, it happens also a lot that they come intrinsically without a clear reason, or that they are generated in a situation of choice between alternatives. So you have several alternatives and you choose to do one. Okay, so, and these things are almost, are studied much less. These situations are studied much less. And so it's interesting to see in general what happens in this situation. What is the dynamics of the generation of the signal that is might be intention? But there is another reason, and the second reason has to do with the segregation between attention and intention. And the segregation between attention and intention is very difficult, because in particular when you talk about intentions to make sakats, because sakats and visual attention are tightly linked. I mean, when you make a saccade, your attention goes in a way that cannot be prevented to the location of the saccade endpoint. Even if you try during the just before the saccade, even if you try to allocate attention to another location, you cannot do it. This is now. It doesn't mean that you cannot do it during the memory, yes, that precedes the saccade. But it is clear that they are very tightly linked, and the same activity has been interpreted by Mickey Goldberg and his collaborators as either visual memory or attention. So how can we segregate between the two? So I think that part of the difficulty of segregating between the two has been the way that that experiments have been done. I mean, like I said before, there is basically, usually, in order to study intention, you create for the monkey a one-to-one correspondence between a limited set of sensory signals and intentions it's really one-to-one in the sense that each instruction corresponds, if you want, this arrangement has an important advantage, and the advantage is that we say that intentions are inaccessible in principle, but when you have this one-to-one correspondence, you can assume, since the monkey always responds in the same manner, you can assume, it is reasonable to assume that intentions are indeed generated. Okay, so it overcomes the basic difficulty. This is the way to overcome the basic difficulty with the subjectivity of intentions. But there is a drawback. You pay a price for it. And the price is that when you have this one-to-one correspondence, that suggests that activity in a certain, let's say, that corresponds to a certain intention, that activity of a given cell corresponds to a certain intention, it can always be the instruction that actually causes this activity. And this is, I think, the reason this is another technical reason why it has been so difficult to segregate between attention and intention. So there is an intrinsic reason that they are very close, they overlap, attention and intention overlap in terms of anatomy, in terms of psychology, and in terms of physiology. And there is a technical reason that the way that intentions are usually studied is inappropriate for the segregation. So this is the second reason that we studied, and actually major reason that we studied free choice. And the way we did it was like this. Fixation spot, then two simultaneous targets come on. The monkey, of course, must keep the eye on the fixation spot. The targets go off, there is a memory interval, and then the monkey should make a response, should look at one of the targets. Now, the monkey don't know which target, only one target will be rewarded, but the monkey don't know which one it is. Okay? So, at this stage, the targets look identical. They are obviously two targets, well segregated. They are identical, and the monkey doesn't know which one will be rewarded. And therefore, in roughly 50% of the cases, the monkey is rewarded. I'm sorry?
Is it important that you don't reward the monkey 100%?
Well, the only thing is actually is that the only thing that is important is that the monkey does not, actually it is 55%, because we randomly interleave between all kinds of, I will not get into the technique now. The only important thing is that the monkey does not sort of break the code of where it's going to be, where the reward is going to be. I mean, if the monkey could, of course, it's a computer program that does it. I mean, it is not random. It is not random, and we try to equalize the number of. What is important to us is that there will not be the situation in which there is a target on the right and a target on the left, but the monkey already knows that the target on the right is irrelevant.
I asked if you always reward. Would it change anything?
What if you're 100%?
Yes, of course. We don't want a situation, I mean, I'm sorry?
The monkey would probably always go to the same place.
Exactly. I mean, the monkey will always go to the right.
Why?
Because it's more convenient. And what the monkey, and even if you don't do this, if you don't allow, we therefore do not try to equalize the number of cases in which the monkey goes to the right and the monkey that goes to the left, okay? But this is not enough, because what then they do is to alternate. To go one trial to the right, one trial to the left. One trial to the right, one trial to the left. And
this is if you reward 100%, that's what will happen?
No, no. If you reward 100%, they will probably go to the same direction. They do it. I mean, no, I don't know. These things are interpretations. But maybe the monkey finds a solution and sticks with it, so to speak. I mean, the monkey finds always when you train these monkeys in these complicated tasks, you have to be careful that the monkey will not misinterpret what you mean, because it happens when you're not careful, and then it's difficult to unroot it, so to speak. So, in any case, the monkeys usually go for, it is difficult to make decisions, especially if they're free, and so, even in 50% situation, the monkey would find solutions which basically, I mean, the most, what we saw is that I think the most popular is alternation. We actually found it because we had a bug. I mean, never mind right now a program bug. Never mind right now the details. But so we have to alternate. So it is not enough to try to equalize. We set the direction which will be rewarded by looking at two counts. One is the times that the monkey looked right versus left. It's not random, of course. I mean, it's not a. So it's a, the times of the number that the number went right versus left.
In the past.
Until now, in this block, for each block a block of trials start, and we.
So you want to force the monkey to.
Actually, let me tell you first of all how it looks. So in a block we have in a typical block we have first of all now. Before, so we had the memory saccades, and in the previous chapter they were called the memory prosaccades, and now we call them, to segregate them, deterministic memory saccades. It's exactly the same thing as you see, and we look at them after essentially this schematic cell has this response field, so it's either up or down, okay? The, So we call it deterministic plus or minus. And now there are also, there is a third class of cells, which are the free choice memory saccades, which look like these. The stimulus is up or down. Obviously, only one of, we always set it so that one of the direction falls in the opposite, in the preferred direction, and the other in the opposite. Okay? And the monkey makes, and basically it's the, it's one class of trials, but the monkey makes, the monkey segregates it into two subclasses, so to speak, according to the direction of the movement, which we call choice plus and choice minus. Okay? Now, so we have counts. Now, always, I didn't go into the technique. We try everybody. I mean, not it's not it's a standard standard practice. We try to keep the number of hits in all the classes the same.
So your rewarding is not random. It takes into account the past history.
Exactly. So we a block starts. All counts are zero. And now for the, and by the way, I didn't say that besides the, these two classes, there might be other classes. For instance, in particular, memory anti-saccades, also in the same block. Now for each block, for each trial type, we count the number of hits. And we try, essentially, usually we try to equalize the number of hits. So that let's say we have deterministic up and down saccades, and the monkey did until now six hits up and seven down, then the next trial is bound to be an upward saccade.
So you want to make it less free?
It is not a... Now, it is, wait, I mean, let me... So now we have two counts, essentially. One, in order for the case of the choice trials, we have two counts. One, I mean, we have the number of hits upward and the number of hits downward. And now we look at two counts. One, is the this difference, and the other, we also have the number of cases in which the monkey looked, made the movement to the same direction as the previous trial, and the number of in which it made the opposite direction. So keep versus alternate, okay? So we form two differences, up minus down, let's say, and keep minus alternate. And the one that is farther, that is the bigger, determines the criterion according to which we will select the next location, the location of the next trial. Location of the target, sorry.
Location
of the rewarded target, I mean, I'm sorry. The location of the rewarded target, okay? And then the within the criterion, the one that is the lesser one is the one that will be rewarded. So we try. So the monkey generally does not figure out because the mean performance is 55%. So it is if the monkey goes, let's say I'll give you an example. If the monkey goes left right, so. Right, so it is bound to get almost bound to get a reward on the right. So it is likely, I mean, one thing that we plan to look, I mean, we haven't looked, is in situations in which the monkey probably knows what the rewarded target, but this is all details. What is important is that the reward rate is roughly random, which suggests to us that the monkey, that although the computer is making a lot of calculations, the monkey doesn't figure them out. For the monkey, it is a situation, the monkey
as
has, as if it was
you
random.
Say if you would do it randomly, nothing would change.
Essentially.
So what's the reason why you don't?
Because we want to, I mean, you always, I mean, if you do it, you want always want, first of all, I want to prevent, there are two things. First of all, I want to prevent the monkey from following a clear strategy. Of course, although to these results, to this, which I'm showing you now, it won't really matter. I don't want the monkey to alternate. And secondly, because I want to get enough data. I don't want, I mean, one drawback, one very, very, a simple drawback of a situation in which the monkey will always look right is that I will not have data for the left and will not be able to compare it. So in this way, We have about the same number of...
But we did figure out that there was some other...
That what?
That, so you say the monkey didn't go always to the right, and only did...
No, the so obviously the monkey figures out that, that there is some change that should be done, and it is not alternation. Now, we didn't even check. In principle, it could be...
Is there an optimal strategy?
Well, I mean, if the monkey does third-order statistics, then the monkey could figure it out. It's, I mean, I cannot do it. Okay, so...
You can't figure it out.
I get confused. How can you remember? There are so many types of trial. And, it's not... So it's... extremely unlikely. Okay, so basically, I think that there are two situations. There are extreme situations in which the monkey might figure out, like I told you before, left, 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 left. I mean, but the typical situation, the monkey does not figure out.
You're saying that if it's purely random, the optimal strategy is to look left.
Because
you're better. Any strategy
is
but anything is viable. Right?
Well, I don't know. I mean.
So do something simple by just looking left since it's
40%. That was totally random, I think. They spend half. I think psychological behavior is if you estimate 50%, you spend half your time looking in each direction, right?
That's, yeah, but if you go left, right.
It depends. I mean, so you start to put if it's total random.
Then
you don't have. I mean, in order to obtain interesting.
Behaviorally, though. Let's say it's 70% on the right, 30% on the left. People will look 70% on the right, 30% on the left.
30%? I mean, what do you mean?
You get a weighted, is it a weighted random?
You get a weighted random. Optimal strategy is 70% on the right, so always look on the right, right?
I didn't get you, sorry.
So let's say the reward appears on the right 70% of the time.
20% of the time?
70%.
Ah, but the if it's long enough, I mean, if the block is long enough, then it's 50, right? I mean, it's very different situation from this state in which you modify the weights. I mean, so you can make it more worth it to go to the right than to the left. This is a very different situation.
So, you want to say that if you give reward 70% to the right and 50%, the optimal strategy would be always go to the right.
Yeah, but behaviorally
that's not what people can do.
Behaviorally, it's been saying
But then there are all kinds. So in any case, I mean, this is what we did, and I think that the data probably shows. I mean, almost certainly that the monkeys in our case didn't figure it out. Okay, so this is so we have so one more thing that I forgot to tell you about the background, and this is. That since the classic experiments of Goldberg, Mickey Goldberg and his collaborators in the early 80s, basically of Bushnell, Goldberg, and Robinson, in 1981, they did a classic experiment in which, I mean, basically, it was known before from the work of Wurtz and Goldberg and others that when a monkey does a saccade, then in many structures, like the superior colliculus and other structures, visual responses are enhanced when the target is when the stimulus is a target for this saccade. Okay, so there is saccadic enhancement, and they had this hypothesis that actually the enhancement is related to the attention that goes with the saccade. But in the colliculus, they did not find it. And in this pair of studies in 81, although it was before LIP was defined, and they compared the parietal cortex and the frontal eye fields. And in each case, they compared two situations. They asked whether a cell is enhanced in a saccade situation, and whether it is enhanced in a peripheral attention situation in which there is no movement, only peripheral attention to the target. And they saw that in the parietal cortex, over the population, I mean, the enhancement was similar in the in peripheral attention and the saccade, whereas in the frontal eye field there was much more enhancement in the, to the saccade than the peripheral attention. Basically, there was little, if any, I don't remember exactly, the enhancement, peripheral attention enhancement. So, and since then it was known, I mean it has been known for a long time, that the basic, and now it is known in basically all over extrastriate cortex, that attention modulates visual responses, the intensity of visual responses. And typically, attention enhances visual responses. In other situations, it suppresses, but in any case, modulates. So this is a sustained cell, like we saw before. Again, in the regular memory saccades, and again there is a visual brisk visual response and then sustained activity until the movement. For convenience now, we calculate a differential activity let's call it a deterministic differential activity.
Deterministic plot versus deterministic plot.
Exactly. And it is plotted below. So it starts in this cell, there is no, it varies during the initial fixation, it fluctuates a little bit, and then, but shortly after the target onset, it becomes very strongly to the direction, and until the target, and then goes down. Movement, and then goes down. Now, what happens in a free choice trials? So, what happens is that if it was all intention, we would expect, maybe would expect no activity in this class of trials. But you see that initially there is activity in both classes of trials, but then slowly as the trial proceeds, the activity in this class, in the choice minus, goes down. So this is choice plus, this is choice minus, and we also calculate the difference between the two classes. Okay, so what do we see here? We see several things. First of all, during the baseline, let's start with here, I'm sorry. During the movement, roughly at the time of the movement, there is clear choice differential activity. It is clearly in choice plus, it is clear that in choice plus trials, the cell is much more active than in choice minus. Which means that, which indicates that there is some kind of a preparation for movement to me. Because remember, here we broke the, it is not the case anymore in which there is a one-to-one correspondence. It is exactly the same pattern of stimulus in both classes of trials, right? It is exactly the same stimulus, and therefore, this is, this activity around the time of the saccade is not caused by this visual stimulation per se. Cannot be caused by the visual stimulation per se. Okay, and since it precedes the movement, I think that clearly the most likely possibility is that it is intention, and we'll.
The right one. Right?
I'm sorry, I didn't get.
On the right column, see that here.
Yes. Okay, so let's go back. I'm sorry, it's not plotted. One second. Okay, so this is in that plus and that minus, there is a single target which falls in the receptor field or outside.
That's the left column.
Okay? In the choice, there are always two targets, exactly the same pattern of stimulation, but the movement is different.
So the visual stimulus is different.
The visual stimulus is exactly the same in choice plus and choice minus.
Between choice and deterministic,
is that what you're talking
about?
Oh, you talk between choice and the
left column and right column.
Of course, yeah, of course. I'm sorry. In the left column, there is always a single spot. In the right column, there are always two spots. But between the right, the upper right and the lower right, there is no difference. But there is a difference in activity. Okay?
Why? But there is no difference in the usual part of that.
Okay, so first of all, let's go back in time. First of all, there is a clear difference. There is a clear difference in around the time of the saccade. Before that, there is some kind of a build-up. Second, during the like you say, Misha, during the target, there is no difference. Now, this is very significant, right? Because it shows that it suggests that there is no peripheral attention. Now, basically, we have here an attention hypothesis and an intention hypothesis. You could ask, you present two alternatives. Now, let's assume that according to standard thinking, that attention precedes intentions and the saccade. The saccades are precipitated by shifts of attention. Okay, so there are at least two situations. I mean, one is that attention would be shifted to one of the targets, and then and this would basically make the choice. And the second is that there is no difference in attention. Okay, but during the target, there is no attention. During the target, there is no difference. If there is no difference, there is no enhancement or suppression in this cell. Okay, so it already suggests that there is no attention. Okay. Third. So attention, the operational criterion, I mean, we don't test for attention here. And the operational criterion that we use is enhancement. Although enhancement is usually studied, is usually defined in a little bit different, I mean, because you don't use these two targets.
This is for just one cell.
This is one cell. I mean, we start with it.
You say no attention.
There is no enhancement. There is no enhancement. This was not careful. There is no enhancement, and therefore, there is probably no effect of attention on this specific cell. Third thing that we see now, it's if this is intention, if this buildup is intention. And we are talking about free choice. It is interesting to see. Well, not 0, 0, 0. It is obviously. If you look here, it is obviously if you form an average, and if we had done 10 times as many trials, it would clearly be the case. You see that it would be something like this. It's obviously above zero. If you test the statistics of this, it's obviously above zero. Now, the interesting thing is that if you go back in time, you get basically to the beginning of the trial. So during the initial fixation, I'm sorry?
It was already positive.
Exactly. It is. You see that the differential activity in this cell, the differential activity is significantly above zero during the initial fixation. Okay? I'm sorry?
There was fixation before the first protocol.
Remember the structure of the trial.
Okay.
The essentially, you can see here even one correction circuit. So when the computer recognizes that the fixation has been obtained, it starts running the trial. Half a second of initial fixation, quarter of a second of a target, 1 second of memory, and then movement. Okay? So you see here that for this cell, again, it is positive during the initial fixation. What does it mean? It means, I'm sorry?
Statistically significant.
Oh, in this specific cell, it is highly significant. I don't remember the numbers. Even if you look at these, 50 millisecond beams, you see that, with 9 out of 10 being positive, the roughest approximation, it's clearly highly highly significant, whereas on the left, the parallel on the left is insignificant, is not statistically significant from zero.
Looks like if you look at the raw data, you have sub-trials where there is a lot of activity and sub-trials where there is nothing. So maybe lumping it together somehow loses a lot of.
Exactly. The single trial, the trial-by-trial analysis here is very interesting because there is a possibility that there are various stages, but I don't want to get into it. When you look at overall, there is a difference which for this cell is significant. Now, what does it mean? What it means is that the activity of this, the strength of activity of this cell during the initial fixation already, is correlated with the eventual choice that the monkey will make, well, a second and a half roughly later. Okay? So, one has to be careful in talking about what free choice and free will. In interpreting it as, but one could say it is suggestive that that the choice here is not completely free in the sense that it is already constrained by this activity. Okay, this.
There was some predisposition for the monkey to go left or right.
I'm sorry. That it is exactly a disposition. It is not a. I'm not saying that this cell it obviously does not determine entirely the behavior of the monkey, but on the other hand, it looks like a constraint on the choice. Putting constraint on the, at this time it is speculation.
But I think this is right. You really have to do trial by trial, construct an ROC curve or something to really decide whether or not activity predicts choice.
But the average makes it clear that this is correlated.
You probably need multiple recordings to do real-time prediction.
I'm sorry? I didn't get
it.
It's probably not enough statistics for one cell. Could you predict from one cell whether or not?
The question is, then what accuracy can you predict
you do
from one cell?
Okay, so now...
The average says you do better than chance, but maybe it's...
We are running, we are in the initial stages of running trial by trial statistics, and I don't want to talk about them. But to put it into context, there are two experiments in the literature which are somewhat close to this, and one is by Shadland and Newsom, which, the initial publication appeared in 1996 in PNAS, but recently, very recently, they had a paper in Journal of Neurophysiology. And it is similar and different to our paper. It is different in the sense that they talk about perceptual decisions. Okay, and it's actually very different in many ways. But in their perceptual decisions, they also have, in the 50% situation, in which the monkey has basically guesses whether the movement was to the left or to the right, they also have an offset, and the offset can predict, not very powerfully, but can predict to a certain extent the behavior of the monkey. And probably here it will be just the same. But I think that the trial by trial analysis, if successful, can yield much more interesting observations. But there's no point in talking about something that is not done. Okay. So essentially, we have a signal which, in the choice, we have a signal here in this cell. We have a signal which begins above zero, a buildup that is clearly related to the saccade. Okay. Now it could be, since saccades are tied to attention, one could assume that this increase is related to the attention. A surge of attention that accompanies the preparation of the saccade. But if this thing was attention, then it would be especially difficult to explain the lack of enhancement. So we have a signal which is zero from the start, above zero from the start of the trial, and then slowly increases maybe mostly towards the saccade, never mind the exact dynamics here, mid-trial dynamics, and therefore probably represents the intention. And interestingly, superimposed on it, there is a strong visual discharge, okay, which is similar in the choice plus and choice minus trials. And therefore is now, this area is interesting because it, on the one hand, it is part of visual cortex, but on the other hand, it is a late part of visual cortex and an early part of the sensory motor of the chain of sensory motor association areas. Okay, so being part of visual cortex and having many visual cells in it, maybe the attention signal is correlated, is carried by the visual cells. So we looked at the visual cells, and this is a visual cell according to the standard dissociation by time criteria that we looked before, right? And now let's look what happens in the free choice trials. What happens is that they look, there is a response in both classes of trials. And if you look how they are related, they are roughly the same. So it seems that this visual cell is not enhanced or suppressed, strongly enhanced or suppressed, and therefore it is unlikely to be to carry the attention per se. This is the population. I didn't write here, and I don't remember the exact number of cells, but both classes had more than 100 cells. This is the black line is the intentional cells, roughly 100 intentional cells, and the gray line roughly 100 visual cells. Okay. And the visual cells start at about zero, and remain about zero. I'm sorry? Oh, this is post-saccade. I mean, this is not interesting for us now.
Why is there a differential dip in the post-saccade?
Why is there a difference? I mean, after the saccade, I don't go now into all the details. First of all, in part of the trials, After the saccade, we do a recalibration so that the light turns back on, the target light turns back on, and the monkey must look at it. If you don't do this, you get if you don't do this recalibration, you get errors of, in the behavior that increase and increase and increase. Until the, so that's already part of, I don't want to get into it. It's not part of the story. I mean, for us, the part of the story is until the saccade right now. And this is the intentional. So the intentional population shows, the attentional population shows no enhancement, zero baseline, no enhancement, and zero subsequently.
The visual.
The intentional population shows almost from the start of the trial, basically from the start of the trial, increased activity in the choice plus, no enhancement, and then a build-up which peaks around the time of the saccade. I still want to do another chapter, so I mean, or maybe it's not realistic. So question is if to get into details here or in a little more details, or and give up the last chapter or go into the last chapter. But okay, maybe I complete this and then we stop. Okay. So basically, I mean, this is the story. I mean, what, now there is a little bit of statistics that I put on, but they don't really change anything. I mean, so if you look at the visual cells, compare visual choice to the visual cells in the choice trials to the deterministic, you see that in the baseline, both of them are around zero. We look at the differential activities. Yes, this is the histograms of the differential activities in a visual phase and a motor phase. During the visual phase of the visual cells, they are around zero, as we saw. I mean, there's no surprises, and there will not be surprises here. During the baseline, it is around zero. During the visual phase, in deterministic trials, there is strong response. Yeah, but in the choice trials, there is little response, no response basically. I mean, it's not different from zero. In the motor phase, both of them are back to zero. If you look at the intentional cells, again, the differential activities in the choice and the deterministic, it is in the deterministic saccades, it is around zero. And the what? I'm sorry? Cell count. I mean, this is histograms. The y-axis is cell counts. The x-axis is the differential activity. If you look at the intentional cells in the deterministic saccades, it is around zero. But in the choice saccades, it is above zero. It is clearly, and there seem to be two, although I'm not certain yet, there seem to be two categories. One is there is a tail, a rightward tail. I mean, so there are cells like the one that you saw before, the intentional cells that you saw before, that are significantly, by themselves, are significantly more active in the choice plus trials. But in general, in addition, it seems that in general, the population is shifted to the right. Even if you take out these cells, then the population is shifted to the right. I mean, during the visual phase, In the deterministic saccades, there is much more activity in choice plus than in choice minus trials, because in choice minus trials, there is no target in the receptive field, right? But in the choice trials, in which there are always trials in the receptive fields, the differential activity remains as it was during the baseline, basically. So it is shifted to the right, yes? But if you look, I don't show it here, but if you calculate this, the response of the intentional cells in the choice trials during the visual phase minus the baseline phase, so sort of a second order difference, you see that it is absolutely symmetric around zero. So nothing changed from the baseline phase to the visual phase in the intentional cells in choice circuits, okay? In the motor phase, the intentional cells are active both in the intentional, in deterministic and the choice trials, okay? So the population reflects just what we saw before on the level of single cells. We did one more thing, and this is to define, I mean, still, one could argue that beyond these populations, there are correlations of the single cells that get lost, because it is independent here. So we looked for each cell at the selectivity index. We defined the selectivity index again for the different phases and the different groups of cells, and the selectivity index is differential activity in choice trials over differential activity in deterministic trials. Okay, so basically, and this can be visual, phase can be visual or a baseline or motor, and you can apply it to the intentional cells or the visual cells, okay? And essentially, what do you expect? If there is no differential activity in choice, then the selectivity index will be zero, right? If there is, on the other hand, if the differential activity in choice is the same as in the deterministic trials, then it would be one. That is, for instance, if it is determined specifically, if the response is determined by the visual stimuli, the selectivity index is likely to be zero. Okay? If it is totally determined by the movement, it is likely to be one. Right? Okay, so, and what we get is exactly what we expect. For the during the visual phase, both for the visual units and for the intentional units, the selectivity indices are positioned around zero, which means that the visual responses are largely determined by the targets. They are bottom up in our data. Whereas during the motor phase, I mean, it doesn't make much sense to look at the visual units, but in the intentional units, it is very close to one. So that by the time that the saccade is made, or shortly before it, the activity in the choice trials is nearly, the differential activity is nearly equal to the activity in deterministic saccades. So, free choice memory saccades allow a critical experiment for dissociating. I mean, this dissociation has been, is elusive for a long time, but I think that using free choice, I mean, this allows, basically the question is whether all the activity is visual or attentional, in particular attentional, or is there intentional activity as well? And I think that this is basically a critical experiment to dissociate these hypotheses. And it shows that intentions are present in LIP, that intentions, first of all, intentions are present in LIP. Second, in the situation of gradual emergence of intentions, it shows that intentions are present right from the start, right? And so it is in specifically, choice is correlated with pre-stimulus activity. Now, I must emphasize, however, that I do not mean, I think that there is a lot. So does the question comes up, I mean, can come up, whether...
it's a critical experiment, but what is the question?
The question is, I mean...
Whether there are intentions or not,
yeah,
at LIP.
In LIP. Whether intentions are represented in LIP, or can you explain all the activity as visual and attentional? Visual memory, visual attention. Yeah? Can you explain all the activities?
This motor units, they cannot be explained as visual.
Well, first of all, you could say that except for the motor units, some people say this. I mean, this is.
But motor units are clearly.
No, but if, but even for the motor units, you see, because during the time of the saccades, I mean, not motor units like this slow buildup, but even take motor units. I'll show you, I mean, I'm not going to get into it, but I'll show you examples from a recent excellent paper of the Goldman-Rakish group. Okay, they do the typology. They look what types of responses. They basically see, it shows that in both in area 8A, in prefrontal area 8A, and in LIP, there are the same types of responses. And you see that even take a motor unit by any criterion, like this one, okay, which is roughly quite sharply tuned around the time of the saccade. This, I mean, one could say, you know, attention always accompanies saccades. This has been shown by Heiner Deubel and other psychophysicists, okay? So you could say this is the attention that accompanies saccade.
So these motor neurons could still be related to attention?
In this case, I mean, this could, you could offer this as a non-motor explanation for this activity. This is the attention that accompanies saccade. I'm not getting now into all the subtleties, I mean, of this, but the critical point is, I'm sorry?
I don't understand now what you mean by attention or intention.
Attention is a preparation of is a change, filtering. In essence, it is very simple. Attention is changes in the sensory system that prepare it for perception of in the future. I mean, immediate future or long-term future.
So if you have motor neurons which are not sensory, why would you call it still attention?
No. If when you say motor units, the question is how you define it. If you define it, I'm not talking about cells in the spinal cord. Or when you have cells that have that using the dissociation by time criterion appear to be motor. I think that they, in general they are motor, but some people would suggest that it. I mean, you could, in an extreme manner, this is an extreme explanation. I'm not saying that I believe it. I mean, but you could say that this is the attention that accompanies the motor act of the saccade. This is the saccadic eye movements. You know that.
You said that attention only refers to the sensory part of this.
Right.
But now you say also the motor part. Also can be influenced by attention.
No. I'm not saying it. I'm saying
say
that
the motor part could be interpreted as being attention and not motor.
Ah, so this would mean that this is not motor at all.
Different.
An extreme interpretation could be that this is not motor at all. It is attention.
Still a sensory neuron.
According to this extreme, interpretation, which I don't follow, but nevertheless, so what is different? What is different is that the one-to-one correspondence, in the free choice, the one-to-one correspondence is broken. Here, it is not broken. I mean, it could, when you have a different stimulus, you could always, I mean, never mind how many controls you make, you could always bring it back to the different stimulus. It would be extreme, but you could always bring
it. Seems like even a bigger question. Basically, you're asking if there are any motor cells in LIT at all.
I mean, you could ask that. I mean, that would be extreme. You could, I mean, if you want to check all the possibilities, that would be extreme, but you could ask that and go to an extreme. Now, I think that, but nevertheless, so basically, I mean, but if you take the accepted notion that attention modulates responses, then you cannot explain the lack of modulation, enhancement or suppression in our data using an attention hypothesis. So this is different. I mean, it has sort of indirect evidence for this is the experiment of Snyder and Anderson, in which they compared eye movements and the arm movements. But this is maybe a direct evidence, because this is directly the definition of attention, I mean, the operational definition of attention in neurophysiological terms. Right? And you apply it in this situation, you